This is episode 16 of the Investors Podcast.
Broadcasting from Bel Air, Maryland, this is the Investors Podcast. They'll read the books and summarize the lessons. They'll test the waters and tell you when it's cold. They'll give you actionable investing strategies. Your host, Preston Pish and Stig Brodersen.
All right, how's everybody doing? Hopefully you had a Merry Christmas out there. And today we've got a special guest for you, and his name is Alex Bryan, and he's an analyst covering passive strategies on Morningstar's manager research team. He's led teams of analysts and covers U.S. value, growth, and material sector funds. Prior to assuming his current role in 2012, Bryan was a project manager with Morningstar. He was also a senior data analyst and oversaw the launch of Morningstar's benchmark data service by acting as a liaison between China and institutional clients back here in the United States. He holds a bachelor's degree in economics and finance from the Washington University and graduated magna cum laude. And he also holds a master's degree in business administration with high honors from University of Chicago's Booth School of Business, which is an outstanding school. So I think we can confidently say that Alex really knows what he's talking about. And we are very excited to have him on the show to talk about finance and investing securities. So, Alex, one of the things that I really like to do is separate my broker from my analyst tools and resources. And so with that said, I'm a huge fan of Morningstar. I use Morningstar all the time because I don't feel like I'm getting biased information and feedback and like some broker's trying to sell me something. I feel like I'm getting very unbiased information. And so for anybody out there listening, that is my primary resource. I think that the Bloomberg terminal is a little overpriced at $30K. So I think Morningstar offers a good solution to a lot of people out there, provides some good resources. And so we're very excited to have you on the show and representing Morningstar. So just I wanted to throw that out there.
Thanks for having me.
So what we'll do, Alex, is we'll just kick this off, and Stig has the very first question. So go ahead and fire away, Stig.
So, Alex, we're really thrilled to have you. And as you probably know, that one of the reasons why we were so big on having you was that you are expert in ETFs. So a lot of people probably heard about ETFs. A lot of people probably heard about mutual funds. And it might not be reasonable to say what is the difference between ETFs and mutual funds, because there are so many and there come in so many varieties. But if you can just draw up the big lines, so why should I invest, for instance, in an ETF and not in a mutual fund?
Sure. So let's first start off by comparing how an ETF and a mutual fund work. With a mutual fund, an investor will basically give money to a fund company to manage. In return, the investor receives shares in the fund. The portfolio manager then uses that money to purchase individual securities for the portfolio. When an investor wants to take money out of that fund, the portfolio manager may have to sell securities in the portfolio to raise cash for the investor. This could force realized capital gains, which the fund is then required to distribute to all of its investors. So even if investors don't sell their mutual fund, they could be hit with capital gains tax liabilities. And that's true of any capital gains that a fund realizes. So mutual funds don't tend to be the most tax efficient vehicle. They also have to maintain individual client account records, which can increase their administrative expenses. Now, in contrast, an investor who wants to purchase an ETF usually does so from another investor on an exchange, so the fund company doesn't get involved, and that improves tax efficiency because if I decide to sell my shares in the ETF, the portfolio manager doesn't have to sell securities in the portfolio to satisfy my cash needs. They also don't need to maintain individual client accounts, and that can reduce their administrative costs. So there's two benefits of ETFs over mutual funds. One, they tend to be more tax advantaged, and two, they could potentially be lower cost.
And you know, it's funny. Stig and I are reading this book on Tony Robbins right now. Kind of a long read for, I think, the content that's in it. But in general, there's some nuggets in there that I found really interesting. And one of them was this idea of, I mean, he just pounds mutual funds in this book and how much worse they perform than a regular index or ETF, like you're saying. And he says that 96% of actively managed mutual funds underperform the market. And just, I mean, that number is huge. 96% underperform the market. He says, additionally, 49% of fund managers don't even have a dollar in the funds that they're managing. Do you see more and more people stepping away from mutual funds, and do you see them as a dying financial instrument as we move into the future?
The percentage that you cited of actively managed funds that underperform the market seems a little high to me. Actually, based on Morningstar data, I found that 27% of active managers in the large blend category outperformed the S&P 500 over the past decade. Now, that's still pretty low, and that's before taxes, you know. So, and index investing does tend to be more tax efficient than active management because it requires lower turnover. So after taxes, it's likely that even fewer than 27% outperformed. After you adjust for risk and style tilts, which investors can replicate with an index fund, even fewer active managers show any evidence of skill. So I think that 4% or the 96% figure that you cited of managers who underperform the market, that's probably adjusting for things like style tilts and the amount of risk that managers take. But
yeah,
in any case, I agree.
I think that it was adjusted for all those factors.
Right. But in any case, there's a lot of evidence that suggests that active managers in general have a very difficult time of outperforming the market. In order to understand why, it's important to understand that active management is a zero-sum game. So in order for one investor to outperform the market, someone else has to underperform. So in aggregate, because active managers or active investors are defining the market, before fees, their asset-weighted performance should be very similar to a representative indexes. But after fees, because active managers charge more than an index fund does, they should lag on average. And I think that's why you see most active managers underperforming their index.
And the thing I think a lot of people don't realize is when you're 1 or 2% difference from what the market's performing, and then you compound that over a 30, 40 year period, you're talking hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars for people. And I really think that it's very delusional for a lot of people because they're like, oh, well, it's just a 1% fee that I'm paying for somebody to actively manage my fund. And they don't really realize that, A, he's not outperforming an index, and B, that 1% really adds up to a lot of dollars in the long run. So, yeah, that's some very interesting points.
Absolutely. And also, I'd like to mention that so this distinction between active and passive is an important one, and I think there's a really strong case to be made for taking a passive approach to investing because of these cost savings. But that's not the same thing as saying that mutual funds as a vehicle don't have any future left in them. In fact, I was looking at the flows into mutual funds, looking at the division between active mutual funds and passive mutual funds. And actually, passive mutual funds, funds that track an index, have actually had a lot of money flowing into them, while active mutual funds have had a lot of money flowing out of them. So investors, you know, it's not really an important distinction whether you go with the ETF vehicle or the mutual fund vehicle. It's a more important distinction whether you go with an active strategy or a passive strategy. Now, it's true, most mutual funds do tend to be actively managed, but there are some good low-cost passive index mutual funds that are available to investors.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that that's become really popular in the last, I know back in the 90s, you'd have to pay 2.5% just to get into a mutual fund, then you'd have another 2% annual fee. I mean, it was just crazy. And I think that because of the competitive nature, and I think that so many people have realized that, you know, a lot of these mutual funds are not outperforming an index or the market in general, that they've had to bring those fees down, or else it was just going to be a total collapse of the whole, you know, vehicle, the mutual fund vehicle. But hey, Stig, go ahead and go with the third question.
Okay, Alex. So while most active managers don't outperform after fees, there are a lot of ETFs that deviate from market cap weighting in an attempt to outperform traditional indexes. Do any of these funds have any merits?
Sure. So, you know, there are a few strategies that have historically worked well in nearly every market studied over long time horizons. So I'll briefly summarize some of these. So there's value, buying assets that are cheap. You know, Warren Buffett is known for doing that. There's quality, buying stocks with strong profitability and stable earnings. Low volatility, buying stocks that haven't moved around a lot but tend to be more defensive and can weather the business cycle with grace. And that's related to quality to a certain extent. And then there's momentum, which is buying assets that have recently outperformed. Now, there's a long and interesting literature on why these strategies work, but most explanations center around risk. So, you know, a strategy of buying stocks that are cheap could be In fact, taking on more risk, and so you would expect to be compensated for that risk in the form of higher expected returns. So, for example, a company like Sears may look very cheap, but there's a risk that it could become cheaper or go out of business. So if I buy a portfolio of stocks that are cheap, I may expect to earn higher returns for taking on that risk. The other explanation is that there could be behavioral biases that create mispricing in stocks. So investors may extrapolate past growth too far into the future, and that could potentially push prices away from their fair value. So if investors are really excited about what's going on with Amazon, with all its growth, they may be willing to overpay in order to purchase Amazon. Similarly, they may neglect kind of the more boring, slower growing stocks like Hewlett Packard or Lexmark. Investors should look for funds that charge significantly less than actively managed alternatives and that have a simple, transparent methodology. Complexity is often a sign of data mining. Remember, there's only a handful of strategies that have been really well vetted by the academic community, and those are the ones that I mentioned. So if you're looking at a strategy that does something more complex, it's worth being skeptical of that strategy. Also, it's important to remember that a lot of times there are similar alternatives that offer comparable exposure for a lower fee. So we like to see transparency. We like to see low fees with these smart beta ETFs.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
The dream of owning a vacation home can be daunting. From finding the best guests, to the maintenance, to organizing the cleaners after every guest stay. With Vacasa, they make that dream into a reality. As a full-service vacation home management company with vacation homes in key destinations across the U.S., they know how to make owning a vacation home easy and profitable. On top of proactive property maintenance visits by professional local teams, a data-driven booking platform, and around-the-clock support, homeowners earn on average 20% or more revenue from their vacation homes. Vacasa makes vacation home ownership easy. If you're looking to make more from your vacation home by doing less, partner with Vacasa at Vacasa.com. That's Vacasa.com to get started on your dream of owning a vacation home. Have you ever wondered if there's an AI tool like ChatGPT specifically built for the stock market? A tool that not only aids you in your research and analysis process, but also allows for dynamic discussions? Today, I want to share such a tool with you called Meka. Meka is the AI-powered stock research assistant now enhanced with real-time stock data. Meka does a lot of the heavy lifting of sifting through financial statements and company data and delivers it to you nearly instantaneously, and the best part is that it's 100% free. Try it out today and ask Meka questions like, what is the financial health of Microsoft? How much cash does Copart hold on its balance sheet? What is the return on invested capital of Adobe or millions of other prompts? Check it out today for free at Meka.com. That's Meyka.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Range Rover Sport. Range Rover Sport leads by example with their dynamic design that rises to the occasion. It's got powerful on-road performance and commanding all-terrain capabilities, coupled with signature Range Rover refinement. The third-generation Range Rover Sport is the most desirable, advanced, and dynamically capable one yet, redefining sporting luxury. It's got advanced cabin technologies such as active noise cancellation and cabin air purification, offering next-level comfort and refinement. The purposeful cockpit-light driving position sets the tone for a focused interior that promotes exhilarating driver engagement. Award-winning Pivi Pro infotainment is at the heart of the experience and provides intuitive control of the vehicle systems. You can enjoy a dynamic drive and total comfort with optional 22-way adjustable, heated, and ventilated electric memory front seats with massage function. Design your Range Rover Sport at LandRoverUSA.com. That's LandRoverUSA.com.
All right, back to the show. Alex, I have a follow-up question to that, because one thing that you spoke about regarding those ETFs, that was risks. So you're saying that might even be like lower risk, it might be higher risk. But how do you define risk when you're talking about something like an ETF?
It's a great question. So there's a lot of ways to define risk, but I think the most useful is probability of loss and magnitude of loss when it does occur. It's difficult to get a handle on how you measure risk. One way we like to look at risk is volatility. So looking at how much an ETF or a fund moves around, the more volatile a fund is, the wider the dispersion in possible outcomes, so the greater the probability of loss is. Another way that a lot of investors look at risk is tracking error, or the risk of underperforming the market for an extended period of time. Now, when you take any of these smart beta type bets, such as buying stocks that are cheap, there's a risk that, you know, these things, even if they work well over the very long term, they can underperform for many years. So if I'm an investor in these strategies, I have to be comfortable with that risk of potentially underperforming during a potentially bad time. You know, value, it looks really great if you go all the way back to the 1920s, but during the financial crisis of 2008, 2009, value strategies underperformed because they were overweight in financials. So you have to be comfortable with these risks that you're taking on and really have a long-term horizon to profit from them.
Yeah, that last part is the real important part. I think a lot of people, they think, oh, well, I'm making these decisions and I'm going to hold it for 5 years. And they think that that's long-term. But I think that, you know, you look at a guy like Buffett and Charlie Munger and all these other just amazing financial investors that use a value approach. I mean, they're truly buying it to own it forever. They're buying it as an equity purchase and they don't ever plan on selling it. So that last point's very important.
Yeah, and keep speaking about risk, and this is really an interesting topic. Alex, would you say that by investing in ETFs, which is like hundreds of companies, you are actually limiting your risk, partly because you are investing in a huge amount of companies, but also because you might be buying ETFs in larger companies that might be less risky?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So to the extent that stocks in a portfolio are not perfectly correlated, you can reduce your overall risk by combining them in a portfolio, right? So that's because these stocks, their volatility can offset one another to a certain extent. So let's take a really simple example. Let's say you have two companies. One just makes sunblock, another just makes umbrellas. The umbrella company is going to have a lot of sales at a time when the sunblock company is going to have low sales and vice versa. So this idea of combining stocks into a portfolio is useful from that perspective. You tend to offset your gains and losses by having a lot of different companies that are not perfectly correlated with one another. So an ETF is useful because it reduces this risk. It spreads this risk out among a large number of companies. Now, there's a lot of different ways that you can make targeted bets of ETFs. So there's ETFs that target small cap stocks. There's ETFs that target the broad market. Anytime you're deviating from a broad market ETF, you are taking on potentially more risk. So for example, investing in a small cap ETF will tend to be more volatile than a large cap ETF. And that's because small cap companies do tend to be more sensitive to the business cycle than their large cap counterparts. But in any case, diversification is always a good plan, no matter what you're doing. You're not paid to take on company-specific risk. So if I just hold one company in my portfolio, I'm taking a lot of risk that I could have diversified away had I held this stock in a broader portfolio. So that's not a necessary risk. I want to get rid of that risk to the extent that I can by using a diversified ETF or a diversified mutual fund.
And I think for the audience, I think a lot of people need to understand that your most important thing you've got to do is protect your principal. For these people that go out there and think that the most important thing to do is to get a 70% return for the year, that's fun and that's exciting and that's really awesome if you can do it in 1 year. But the fact of the matter is that person who can protect their principal and minimize their losses is probably the most important thing you can do, because if you can grow it at 10 or 20% every year and on the down years only lose maybe 1 to 3%, that's a person who's really going to have an enormous amount of financial success, because typically the person who has that 70% year, the following year they have a negative 120% loss that they don't tell you about. So this discussion about risk mitigation, how do I protect my principal, is something that separates professional investors, insiders, from people that are just really amateurs and don't know what they're doing. So great discussion there on the risk. Stig, you had mm-hmm. something you wanted to say?
Yeah, because, you know, I don't own any ETFs myself, but I think the whole idea of a passive managed ETF is, for most investors, a really good idea, because When you hear about these people who are making, like, as Prisoner saying 70% a year, that is impossible if you own like an ETF. Almost impossible, because you might be owning like 100 shares. And these guys who are making like 70 or 100% a year, they might only be holding one or two, say a tech stock, for instance. So they're taking huge risk, which you don't see. You only see and hear about the returns. And as Preston is saying, you know, next year they might go broke.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And actually, Stig, if I can jump in. So absolutely mitigating risk on the downside, that's where that separates the professionals from the amateurs.
Yep.
It's really difficult to overcome a large loss because, you know, a lot of investors don't have the emotional fortitude to stick with a portfolio through those painful times. And if you stick to an index portfolio, that can help take the emotion out of the equation. You don't have to worry about, you know, is this manager someone I should fire because they've underperformed in this year? You're really sticking with, you know, this broad-based index portfolio, and that I think will serve investors well over the long term.
Yep. Hey, so I got a question for you, and I know I actually do not like being asked these kind of questions, so I apologize if you don't want to answer the first part of this question. I completely understand, but I'm going to throw it out there anyway because I'm just curious if you will answer it. If not, then we'll just focus on the second part. So the question is this. What are your top two favorite ETFs and why? For example, maybe you could throw out there because they have a certain expense ratio, they have a good track record, the bid-ask ratio is good, whatever. And if you're not comfortable naming that, we completely understand. But what would be your thought process? How would you go through kind of assessing it at a very generic and high level? How would you go through assessing the pick of an ETF?
So one of the funds that I like is Schwab US Dividend Equity ETF, ticker SCHD. And that targets dividend paying stocks with high cash flow relative to their debt, high return on equity, high dividend yields, and a high 5-year dividend growth rate. This gives it both a quality tilt and a value tilt, which may help it perform a little bit better than the market during downturns. So we talked about mitigating downside risk or reducing the risk of substantial losses. I think this is a fund that can help investors weather market downturns better than most. And as a result, that may help boost its long-term performance. So those are some of the reasons why I like this particular fund. But one of the best things about this fund is this expense ratio, which is only 7 basis points, or $7 for every $10,000 that you invest in it. That's comparably priced to a traditional S&P 500 index fund. So I talked about the importance of looking for smart beta funds that are not much more than traditional index alternatives. This is one which is priced right at the low end of, you know, your traditional S&P 500 index funds. So for those reasons, I think that's a pretty solid core holding for investors in the U.S. In the international arena, I like Schwab Fundamental International Large Company ETF. Ticker on that is FNDF. This focuses on developed market stocks outside of the U.S. And I think right now valuations in developed markets outside the U.S. are more attractive than U.S. market valuations. This fund basically weights its holdings based on fundamental measures of size, including sales, retained operating cash flows, and dividends plus share buybacks. This causes it to overweight stocks that are cheap and underweight stocks that are expensive relative to these metrics. When this fund rebalances, it increases its exposure to stocks that have become cheaper against these metrics and relative to their peers, and it trends positions in stocks that have become more expensive. So essentially, it's a value strategy, but one of the things I really like about it is it's one of the cheapest international value funds available. It does charge a 32 basis expense ratio, which is a little bit more than what you would have to pay for a U.S. value fund, but in the international arena, it's one of the cheaper options available.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in over 20 strategic locations. They have extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com. As someone who's constantly on the road and traveling, Briggs & Riley has been a game changer that ensures my travel experience is phenomenal. I'm a satisfied customer of Briggs & Riley myself, and I can certainly tell you that their luggage performs. It's extremely durable, it has amazing features that make packing and getting around easier, and they have the best lifetime guarantee in the industry. If your bag is ever broken or damaged, they'll repair it free of charge, no questions asked, even if your airline damages the bag. They also just released their Simpatico collection of hard-sided luggage. It has this new one-touch feature which allows you to expand your luggage, pack it, then compress it to its original size so a carry-on can still fit in the overhead compartment, plus many other cool features. If you want luggage that was awarded the best carry-on by Forbes, then now's the time to get it. Get your new and improved luggage at Briggs-Riley.com. That's Briggs-Riley.com.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
All right, back to the show.
Wow, Alex, that was some great tips, and I don't know if Fritz and I should check that out as well. Do you have any idea of the performance over the last, say, 10 years or something like that?
Actually, so these two funds have not been around for 10 years. I believe they're both launched within the last, well, I know the Schwab Fundamental International Large Company Fund was just launched, I think, in the last year or so. The Schwab U.S. Dividend Equity ETF has been around for, I think, 4 years or so. So we don't have a 10-year track record. We have the record of their indexes, and their index records have been good. But again, I like to discount back-tested performance and look at the live track record to the extent possible. But in any case, I think the strategies that these funds pursue is very reasonable. They're both taking a value tilt, buying stocks that are cheap. And historically, that strategy has worked pretty well. The U.S. Dividend Equity Fund also looks for high-quality dividend-paying stocks, stocks that have good profitability. These are stocks that tend to be a little bit more mature, a little bit more stable, and could potentially weather market downturns better than most. So I think the strategy is reasonable. The expenses are attractive. Our expense ratios are low. So for those reasons, I would feel comfortable owning both of those. And in fact, I do own both of these funds, as full disclosure.
Fantastic. That's phenomenal. And so for people, if you don't know what basis points are, so he was saying it was 7 basis points. So if you're talking a 1% fee for this, it would be a 0.07% fee whenever you say it's 7 basis points, just to kind of give you an idea of how low the fees are on these funds that he's talking about. Okay, Alex, I mean, you're providing us just fantastic information here. This is awesome. So this is a question that we like to ask all of our guests. What's the best investing advice you have ever received?
So keep costs low. If you look at the evidence behind the link between expenses that you pay and performance, there's no clearer link. The higher your fees are, the less money you keep and the worse your performance is going to be. It's really important to keep costs low so that you can keep more of the money that you earn. That compounds over time and can give you a long-term performance edge. That's one of the reasons I like Vanguard so much, because they price all of their funds at cost. And I think that gives investors a long-term edge. But it's very difficult to beat a market cap weighted benchmark after fees. So I think it's really, really important just to keep costs low. I can't hammer that enough.
Great answer, Alex. And in continuation of this, another question that I really like to ask our guests is if there's any good books that they can recommend. And especially because you're an expert in indexes, perhaps you have a good book recommendation about that.
Absolutely. So The Little Book of Common Sense Investing by John Bogle, I think, is one of the best books on index investing. John Bogle is the founder of Vanguard. And again, like I mentioned, Vanguard basically prices all of their funds at cost. The mutual fund owners in Vanguard actually own Vanguard itself, which is why it's able to do this. But this book, the little book of Common Sense Investing, basically explains that active management is a zero-sum game. So it's a loser's game if you want to try to beat the market, because in order for one person to win, someone else has to lose, and in aggregate, there's no benefit to that. The only way that you as an individual investor can really win consistently is by keeping costs low through a low-cost index fund. So I think this book does a really good job of walking through that intuition and helping investors understand what some of those benefits are of owning a low-cost index fund.
Yeah, you're not going to find a better author than Bogle. So for everybody out there, I would definitely second his Alex's recommendation here with this book. So great recommendation. Hey, Alex, it was really fun having you on the show. We really appreciate you taking time out of your day to talk to our audience and just kind of share all the knowledge, because you're just a wealth of information here. And we just really appreciate you sharing that with our audience.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
All right, so it's that time where we're going to go ahead and answer one of the questions from the people in our audience. And so this question comes from Chris Shaw, and Chris says, I've listened to the book on CD, Warren Buffett and the Interpretation of Financial Statements, and it explains the importance of finding a durable competitive advantage. In the very beginning, it states that you should really know accounting before picking stocks. How much accounting should be considered a full degree or what? So, Stig, what's your opinion?
Well, Chris, it's really a great question. I think if you want to go into individual stock picks, I think you should be proficient in accounting and how much I'll just return to. But if you're more into ETFs, as Alex, our guest, was, then you probably don't need to be as proficient in accounting. I think the problem about answering this question is that you cannot, you know, just put a value on that. I mean, you're asking, do you need to have an degree? Do we need to have a degree in accounting? And no, you definitely don't need to have a degree in accounting. But how much do you need to know? Well, I would say that if you know how to read the income statement, the balance sheet, and the cash flow statement, if you can go through those three statements for a company and understand at least 95% of what's happening, I think you are probably well off. And then when we're talking about key ratios, because there are so many investors that are big on key ratios, and yeah, I'm big on key ratio as well, but I think it's really important that you understand how these key ratios are calculated and how they can be manipulated. So I think that would probably be my benchmark in terms of accounting proficiency. So understanding at least 95% of the three big financial statements, and then the most common key ratios and how they can be manipulated.
So I agree with Stig. I've got the exact same opinion. I think if you're investing in individual stock picks and you don't have a firm grasp on accounting, you're probably assuming a lot of risk. I guess that's the best way I could say it. If I know for me personally, my understanding of accounting greatly increased ever since I started my own business, and I own my own business. And I was actually creating an income statement. I was creating a balance sheet, and I saw how money would flow from one statement to the other statement and how the cash flow statement worked. Whenever I started doing that myself, my understanding and my knowledge of it just went through the roof, and it just started really making a lot of sense for me. And I think for a lot of people, they don't own their own business. And so whenever they look at an income statement, balance sheet, or cash flow statement, it looks like an alien language to them, and they just don't really understand how it's all correlated. But it's like plumbing, okay? The money flows from one statement over to the other statement, and you have to understand how that's linked and what it means as you look at statement to statement. And I guess I'm of the opinion, if you don't understand that fully and you're investing in individual stock picks, you're really assuming a lot of risk by doing that.
Yeah, and Chris, that was probably an even better answer than what I came up with, because it's really not enough that you know how to read an income statement, for instance. You need to know how that income statement interacts with the balance sheet and how the balance sheet interacts with the cash flow statements. So, Preston, that was a great answer.
Thank you, sir. Hey, so that's all we got for today. We're obviously having fun here, and we really enjoy your questions. So if you guys have any questions, go to asktheinvestors.com and submit your questions there. Record them. We really like recorded questions, so record your questions. Send those off to us. We're going to go ahead and put a free signed copy of our book, The Warren Buffett Accounting Book, in the mail for you, Chris, and we'll get that to you shortly. So thanks, everybody, for listening to us, and we really like to thank our guests for coming on the show today, Alex, Brian, and we'll see you guys next week.
Thanks for listening to The Investors Podcast. To listen to more shows or access to the tools discussed on the show, be sure to visit www.theinvestorspodcast.com. Submit your questions or request a guest appearance to The Investors Podcast by going to www.asktheinvestors.com. If your question is answered during the show, you will receive a free autographed copy of the Warren Buffett Accounting Book. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. This material is copyrighted by the TIP Network and must have written approval before commercial application.